Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program of Foundations in Faith, following the Gospel of St. Mark, and today we're using Mark's Gospel, the first chapter, the 29th to the 39th verse. There's a few things that go on in the Gospel, which some we have seen before, some are kind of new to us, so it's a wonderful time to sit back and to reflect and absorb the Word of God, reflect upon it and see what it might mean for us in our lives as well. It begins with, on leaving the synagogue, Jesus met with James and John, went with them to the house of Simon and Andrew. Now Simon's mother-in-law had gone to bed with a fever, and they told him about her right away. He went to her, took her by the hand, and helped her up, and the fever left her, and she began to wait on them. It's kind of like a casual scene at first. After they had left the synagogue, James and John take Jesus and go to Simon and Andrew's house. It's like some friends going to someone's house, you know, for a meal, for refreshments, for relaxation, and so forth. But when they get there, they find out that Simon's mother-in-law has been taken ill, and she's gone to bed with a fever. So Jesus goes in, takes her by the hand, helps her up, and it says the fever left her right away, and she began then to wait on them. Well, in some ways, this is kind of a very interesting piece of the gospel. First of all, you say, well, someone's sick, and then when you get them out of bed, the first thing they do is wait on you. But that was the intention of the visit in the first place, that they were going to Simon and Andrew's, and Simon's mother-in-law was going to fix them something to eat. It was an invitation. So in healing her, first of all, she was going to do what she set out to do. And secondly, there's a deeper insight into that too as well. We find ourselves very often getting into the idea of, you know, praying for people's healing and wanting the Lord to heal us ourselves. And so we kind of develop a sort of dependency on trusting that God will help us through this. We have healing services, we do all of that kind of thing. But underneath it all, it's never really just for the self that these things take place. That in fact, it's always for them to be able to do something for others. When the Lord helps us through a difficult situation, when the Lord helps us through even a physical healing or emotional healing or spiritual healing of any kind, it's not just to dote on us. Although the Lord loves us and he does do these things for us out of care for us, but the underlying intention always is, now we must do something for him. And that something for him is to carry over that kind of healing in our lives, however it is that we might be then enabled to help and to do things for others. The model here in the gospel is Peter's mother-in-law, that the healing is not so that she can just say, oh, gee, no, I feel so much better, but it's so that she can go on and carry out the task that she had intended to do in the first place, which is to wait on the five men who have come to her house for dinner. And one of them happens to be the Son of God, which she does not know, but which at the same time, in serving God's people, she serves the Lord also. So the first thing maybe we can take from the gospel is the goodness and the favors that the Lord gives to us. He is really that we might not only enjoy them ourselves, but that we might do good, therefore, for others with them. If I am healed from a spiritual problem, a spiritual issue, a spiritual disease of some kind, then my mission may well be to help others to do the same when I recognize it, the same way with physical healing. I don't get well and then just ignore people who are not. And even emotionally, it's the same thing, that there is a communal nature to the individual gifts that we receive from the Lord. It's like our vocations. We don't have a vocation to the priesthood just to enjoy the priesthood. We have the vocation to the priesthood to be able to serve others in a priestly capacity. It's the same way with a married couple. They don't have a marriage just to enjoy each other. They have a marriage so that they can share that love that they have with others. Normally, that comes through the procreation of children, and that love overflows into the life of the children. If nature does not so provide that privilege for a married couple, then they certainly have the opportunity to be of service to others in many different sorts of ways. But everything is oriented. I remember I always used to talk about, you know, that service but that kind of in our service industry society comes out as kind of a customer kind of a thing, and that's not what it is. The faith is not customer based, although there's an awful lot of people who want to treat it that way. That in our parishes and so forth, that's always a struggle. We tend to culturally carry over into any organization that gives service the same kind of notion that we have in relationship to government and business and stores and all of that kind of thing. And that really is very detrimental to the whole spirit of a community, to the whole spirit of a faith community. Certainly the faith community is there and it provides service for other people. But that's its main intent, very honestly, is the salvation of souls. It is there primarily to engage people in the kind of faith community that leads them into a fidelity to God and into a love for God and into the kingdom of heaven. So basically, this is exactly what a healing is in the church. A healing that takes place in the church is not just for the sake of the person who's healed in some way, but it's for the sake of the whole church itself, for the community of the believers of which we are a part, no matter how small or how large that community might be. And then, after that, it says, that evening after sunset, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were possessed by devils. The whole town came crowding round the door, and he cured many who were suffering from diseases of one kind or another. He also cast out many devils, but he would not allow them to speak because they knew who he was. Here now we get into the whole idea of the miracles in the gospel. And these, again, are not just simply amazing acts of kindness or power or anything like that. We have to realize and understand that in Mark's gospel, there is kind of an underlying theme. And the underlying theme is that Jesus kind of is the new creator. He is the one who now is going to restore that which has come forth from the hand of God. He is going to heal it in such a way that it can return to its source. And in so doing this, then, part of that is undoing the consequences of sin. We know that in the scriptures, all physical evil is caused by human sinfulness, whether it's moral or physical. So not only the forgiving of sins, but also the healing of physical ailments is part of the triumph and over sin, part of the banishment of sin from the lives of people. We hear this certainly in the Gospel of John in the 20th chapter when Jesus says, as the Father has sent me, I send you. Then he breathes on them, says, receive the Holy Spirit, whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven them. What is the mission of the church? The mission of the church is the forgiveness of sin in the full biblical sense of that word. One piece, and part of that certainly is the sacrament of reconciliation, but the other piece and part of it is to lift the burdens of sin off humanity. It's in this, then, that the fullness of the mission of the church becomes both spiritual and physical. It becomes both taking care of the neighbor, but also serving and loving God. It is the manifestation, therefore, of the wholeness of the created order as it was intended and as it is in the process of returning to the Father. So that when he does this, it is, in fact, not only a creative act of removing the consequences of sin in the lives of the sick in the biblical sense, but it is also a revelation to those around him who has power over the power over sin, who has power over the consequences of sin, God alone. It is a moment of revelation to the people and to the apostles, if they see it in its depth, that somehow or other there is something extraordinary about this man. He is not just a miracle healer that certainly come and go throughout every age, but he is someone who has actual power over the consequences of sinfulness. And concomitant with that in this whole thing is that he also casts out many devils. There is a tremendous skepticism in some parts of the modern world and even within among our own people about kind of the reality and the presence of the devil in the world. Paul the Sixth has reminded us that the devil is a person, that evil is a person, that it is so intensely personal that it is a person. And that we have to take it as such. We cannot say, well, the devil is the invention of Christians to somehow or other excuse the way they behave and the things that they do. There was a great kind of parody on all that back. I think it was in the 60s, I don't know, or 70s, the Flip Wilson show. And it was always, the line was always, whenever he did anything wrong, the devil made me do it. Well, that's kind of a cheap shot at a serious thing. There is evil. And evil is active in the world. We see it all the time. We understand not the horrible things that go on in our world are in some ways almost beyond the capacity of humanity to arrive at those positions. I think certainly we know that there's great power of evil in such things as the whole abortion industry, the Planned Parenthood industry. That's not something that the human being alone and of themselves is simply capable of creating. Was the human being capable of creating the Holocaust or the Third Reich and its execution of 6 million other people besides the Jews, of gypsies, of the disabled, of the homosexual, Slavic people, religious dissenters, all of that kind of thing? Can we really just look at that and say to ourselves, well, that's what happens when people turn bad? I think that almost takes a greater act of faith than it is to say, well, no, there's a force, there is a power behind that. There is something, very sinister behind that, which is far, far greater than what a human person can do on their own and of themselves. So the idea of a belief in the devil is not any more challenging to the human credulity than is the magnitude of evil which humanity is able to create. To say again simply, well, that's within the capacity. Is that within your capacity? Is that within my capacity? Are we capable of something like that? I don't think so. I don't think that's normal. I don't think that's human. I don't care how deranged a person is. That's just not human. And so there is then, therefore, kind of historical evidence for the fact that evil is a real presence in the world, and a presence that is in many times more powerful than the mere human attitudes and capacities and ingenuity and so forth than any of us are able to conjure up. So when we say that Jesus casts out many devils, there are those who would say, oh, well, that's just superstition. Well, is it therefore superstition also to believe in the atrocities that humanity has created that is beyond its own capacity for evil? That seems to me demanding greater credulity than belief in the fact of the existence of powers of evil personified in the world.
And so the whole idea then of the presence of devils, the presence of demons, moving beyond the cartoon characteristics and moving beyond some of the intentionally deceptive imagery and artwork that we find of that, what we do find there is something that seems to be to have the capacity for reality simply from looking at the story of humanity and the progress of the created order. Once again, however, he would not allow them to speak because they knew who he was. And I think that we talked about this the last time too, that he knows they know who he is. And for him to reveal who he is to play to the prejudices and the inability to comprehend of the popular mind. For, as we said before, there was a variety of ways in which people kind of expected the Messiah to be who they expected him to become in the times and in his time in the world. And for the devils to say, well, he is the Messiah, immediately all of these prejudices click into mind and we say to ourselves, oh, well, then he's going to be this and he's going to be that and he's going to be somebody else. And before they get the whole picture of the suffering servant of God, before they get the whole picture of the crucifixion and the resurrection, they would then fixate on a particle, on a fragment of the whole, and that fragment would become absolute. We talked about this before, and it's a very important part of modern understanding of the modern intellectual process, the modern understanding of reality, that what we are beginning to understand is that humanity breaks down reality into pieces in order that they might grasp it, comprehend it, understand it, because we cannot grasp the whole. But when we take those pieces that we understand and we try to make them absolutes, then we have fractured reality. We have destroyed the vision of the living God. We have ruined, in effect, the mission of the Messiah, because what we have done is we have taken a piece and we have said, behold, the whole. We can't do that. That's exactly what the devils want. That's exactly what they do in the kind of fracturing and so forth within the church itself. When Paul VI said the smoke of Satan has entered the sanctuary, that's exactly what was happening. People were fixating on pieces of the whole, especially in relationship to the liturgy. The liturgy is a whole. All the pieces have to be in place to make the whole comprehensible or present to us, really. We fixate on any one part of that, on any one piece of that, which is what was having. It was Cardinal Hume used to say that, you know, the devil was thrilled with our obsession with rearranging furniture in the sanctuary. That somehow or other, the whole, the liturgical whole shattered. And that's what Paul VI was talking about. And people were fixating on a piece of it. And that piece of it became the total reality for them. And in that, they therefore failed to grasp the majesty, the wonder, the absolute wonder of the liturgical moment. And it became instead like a puzzle with half the pieces missing. You saw all sorts of little things about it, but the whole thing disappeared. And the result of that was a very fractured church, for as the liturgical moment is the unifying, the real moment of the whole human community's relationship with God, when we fail to move through the pieces to the reality that lies within it and beyond it, then what we have done is that we have developed a form of worship which is not truly liturgical, which is not truly a communication between the created order and the Creator, spoken through the human voice of matter and spirit, taken up into the Son of God, who communicates in the liturgy with the Father, and brings forth, therefore, the greatness, the wonder, and the presence of God into the world itself and into our lives. This is the main struggle with the liturgy, and Paul VI whatever his complicity might have been in the fracturing of it, who knows? But certainly he recognized the consequences. The smoke of Satan has entered into the sanctuary. And that is because the liturgical reality of the sacrifice of the Mass was broken up into absolutized pieces, which were not put back together again, and therefore were elements of deception, deceit, and dishonesty in so many sorts of different ways. Well, whether it is in the whole movement toward evil of breaking and fracturing the transcendence of the world and bringing it down to the darkness that we have experienced historically in time, whether it is somehow turning the local people's minds away from the truth of who the Messiah was and making them believe him to be something that he was not, no matter what it was, Jesus forbade the demons to do that to the people whom he served and to whom he preached. Then it says, he had, in the morning, long before dawn, he got up and he left the house. All this was happening, the curing of the sick and the driving out of the demons was happening at Simon Peter's house, where his mother-in-law was living. In the morning, long before dawn, Jesus got up and left the house and went off to a lonely place, and there he prayed. We have to kind of understand it's not a great and exhausting work for the Word of God, for the Son of God, to confront the powers of sin and evil in the world. But it is for a human. And Jesus was now not only God, but also human. And in that humanity, seeing, we have to realize, too, that as he does this, when he realizes he has the power to do this, there has to be some kind of consciousness of who he is. And so as a human being, the weight of the mission has to be incredible. Just think maybe in your own lives, just the sense of the responsibility that you have, those who are married and have children, the responsibility you have for the well-being of those children, for the protection of those children, for the healing of those children, for the bringing the children back out of these places of darkness which they can drift into if they are not guided and nurtured and so forth. It can be exhausting. A mother who stays in the home, who works in the home, is usually very tired at the end of the day because she is doing, in a sense, what Jesus is doing at the door of Simon's mother-in-law's home. He is confronting all of the things that can go wrong in the world and trying the best he can to bring nurturing and goodness and peace out of the people he serves and out of the people to whom he has sent. So he goes off, and where does he find a renewal of strength? He finds a renewal in strength in going quietly into a conversation, a relationship with the Father. And so he goes off by himself to a lonely place, and there he prays. There Jesus, the Word, reunites with his Father in an intense and interpersonal way that gives him strength and wisdom, renewal of his mission. But the disciples, of course, go out to look for him. They have no idea that this is going on. And when they find him, they say, everyone's looking for you. And so he is supposed to be so happy because they're trying to cheer him up. Everyone's looking for you. When in fact it means that Jesus once again turns from this nurturing interior relationship with the Father and goes back into the world, into the broken world, into the fragmented world, into the world burdened with the consequences of evil. But he accepts that and he says, let us go elsewhere, to the neighboring country and towns, because I came to preach to them too. This is why I came. And so he went all through Galilee, preaching in the synagogues and casting out demons. It was, you can almost hear, in a sense, a sigh when he says, all right, let's move on then. He's had his time with the Father. He's had his time in prayer and peace. And certainly anyone who exhausts themselves in the work that they do in the world find relief, quiet, and peace. somehow or other in prayer, somehow or other in a sense with the presence of God. If you go somewhere where there is exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, what you find is people drift in and out of there all day long. If it's done in some kind of a public place, people come in for that moment, for when they are in touch with the Lord, when they come in off the streets, they come in from their homes, they come in from business, they come in from whatever they do. And there is kind of almost once again kind of this sigh of relief as we kind of can sink down in front of the presence of the living God. It's sometimes it's this way in our devotional life too, and sometimes it's this way in our private life at home. There is absolutely no reason why we can't have those same kind of quiet moments at home. Everyone has some place, 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, even in their homes, where they can be somewhere at peace, somewhere alone, somewhere communicating with the living God, somehow doing that. And I think that the example of the Lord, he has a burden greater to carry than all of us put together, and yet he finds the strength in his relationship with his Father to come back out and to continue his mission. And he says, because that is why I came. He has a mission, as we all have missions. This is why, for instance, you are married. This is why I am a priest. This is why a religious is a religious. They have come to do what the Lord has asked them to do. We tend to call this vocation, and in that sense, of course, it is, in a very broad sense. It's not like we hear secret voices calling us, but it's because our interior construction lends us to vulnerability to this disposition in life. And the Lord activates that through grace, and we move in those directions. Once again, like going back to the healing of Simon's mother-in-law, not just for ourselves, not just for our own happiness or this is what I want to do, but because we also are sent to all. We are sent on mission to others in no matter what walk of life we have. And it is there that we go, finding not only life and nourishment in that, but finding also a giving, an exhausting giving. If we live throughout our lives and do not realize the tiredness of living for others, then something or other has kind of slipped away from our inner selves, our inner lives. So as we hear this gospel story, recognize and realize the great gifts that the Lord has bestowed upon the church, the great gifts that the Lord asks of us, the great mission he gives to us, and also the power that he gives, forgiveness of sin. Not only do we have to stay close to the confessional in our own lives, but we have to lift those burdens from others to the best of our ability. Let our prayer be that we do not fail the Lord, that we do not take for ourselves what belongs to the many.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.